Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
What's up?
I see. We have the shortened introduction, which must mean that we have a guest on board, and a guest we do have, one of my favorites in the space, one of the best basketball minds out there. Caitlin Cooper is in the building. Caitlin, how are you?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for inviting me back again. Thanks for talking about basketball, and thanks for letting me talk about basketball with you. So I'm excited.
Also excited. Glad to have you back. Honestly, it's probably been too long since we've had you back. That's on me. So I got to, you know, I got to eat that L very early.
Might be on the Pacers too. Well,
just a little bit.
You know, some shutdowns and all that good stuff. It's okay. It's a new season. It is a new Pacers era. And the Pacers look pretty darn good right now. We're going to talk about all things Pacers with Caitlin. Some quick news on the Pacers front, actually. The Pacers and Daniel Tice agreeing to a contract buyout, and the expectation is for him to join the Los Angeles Clippers. Caitlin, I'll start with you. We only got 8 games of the Tice experience in Indiana. Do you have a favorite Tice moment?
I mean, I think my favorite moment might have been in his most recent appearance against the Milwaukee Bucks when he entered the game at the 4 spot. I literally had people in my mailbag asking me over the summer, like, why can't Daniel Tice play at the 4? And I think we now know. I don't think it's ideal for Daniel Tice to be spacing around a Spain pick and roll and shaking up to the wing and having to attack off of that type of an action. But I mean, I think he's still a very reliable big. I think he can help a team off the bench. Obviously, a very good screener, can play in half court sets and maintain flow within an offense. It just wasn't going to fit with the Pacers at what his timeline is. Is at age 31, and Jalen Smith's really popped off here at the beginning of the season. So good luck to Daniel Tice and the playing in the system that is James Harden and the Los Angeles Clippers.
There we go. Steve, do you have early thoughts on the Tice Clippers fit?
I mean, in my head, it's just good for them to have another big, especially if Mason Plumlee is going to be out. So pick and roll chemistry should be important. I think it'll be interesting to see how he fits with Harden. I think the seals will be fun. I don't know if he finishes as well as he needs to. But if what he does will help the Clippers solid defensively, will screen and roll, will execute dribble handoffs, it makes sense.
Makes sense indeed. I think for me, I want to know what the big man rotation turns into once Mason Plumlee is back, projected to be out for a while. If you do have Zubats, you have Plumlee, you have Daniel Tice. How often are you going small, especially with PJ Tucker in tow? I would imagine they're going to want to play him at the 5 as well. Just trying to see how that ends up carving out. As Caitlin mentioned, I don't know how often you'll see Tice at the 4, particularly with this Clippers group. But some early utility, again, as you both stated, like it makes sense as a fit. Before we get into some Pacers talk, Caitlin, I had a question for you as you have the Basketball She Wrote blog on Patreon, and it is tremendous stuff. The film breakdowns in particular, like really enjoyed most recently your breakdown on Indiana versus Philadelphia. And what those empty pick and rolls were looking like against Indiana early on and things like that. But covering the Pacers like you do and having kind of the singular team focus for the most part, I know for me, going from doing primarily Miami Heat stuff into more national NBA stuff, it was a bit of an adjustment for me. And I have the moments where I love watching basketball, so I was going to do it anyway. But there is a difference in covering the league versus really digging into one team and figuring out, like, getting into all the micro stuff with a specific team. How do you kind of balance what you do with Indiana versus zooming out league-wide? And do you ever have the moments where you wish you can kind of broaden out?
I really like following the journey of a team and watching and seeing those developments and knowing that if somebody asks me a question, I'm going to be able to tell you, like, oh, you know, why do they use Miles Turner in this way? How has he changed in his defensive role? How have different coaches used him? And then I'm going to be able to answer those questions because I've watched them play every game and I've watched them play every game twice. So I'm a little bit different that I just like to really zoom in and notice kind of like those little details and player developments and different adjustments that coaches make. I find it very hard. I'm very impressed by anybody who can cover a team full time and also be like hopping on podcasts and just talking about other teams. I tried to do that last night on the Ricky talking about the Sixers and the Celtics, and I'm hoping that I was even like remotely listenable because I feel like, you know, I watched this game tonight, but have I seen enough Celtics to really be commenting on this? I don't know. So it can be very nerve-wracking for me, but I've been trying to get out of my comfort zone a little bit here and there and branch out with some of the shows that are inviting me on.
I got you. Just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Like, I feel like that's, especially in this media space where everyone's trying to find their quote unquote lane, like you have very much carved out, you are the Pacers go-to person in the media space.
I'm kind of like the reverse Quirk Moss. Like, everybody keeps trying to get me out of Indiana and I won't go. He keeps trying to leave Philadelphia and nobody will let him.
Oh, that is a tremendous shot. We now have the promo clip. We've done it. Hey,
you know the funny part though? I feel like every time I've been like, why are the Pacers this way? I've thought of Caitlin for years now. And you should go sub to the Patreon. But the funny part is, even though she digs in on the Pacers, you can learn so much about basketball and apply it to so many other places and principles. So you're going to get the best of both worlds. So there's my promo. I will send the invoice later, Caitlin. Thank you.
Checks in the mail.
Checks in the mail. That's tremendous content.
Free Patreon from now on.
Folks, we've done it. Use promo code DUNK to get 10% off of anyway. All right, let's dig into these Indiana Pacers. Off to a 7-4 start right now. They're fourth in the East. They have not just the best offense in the NBA. They currently, you know, if the season ended today, they currently have the highest offensive rating in NBA history right now, which it's been very fun to watch this group. So, Caitlin, I'll start broadly with you first. What were your expectations of this Pacers team heading into the year versus what you've seen from them so far?
Yeah, so I mean, during preseason, it was a little bit hard to project because Tyrese didn't play the first two games because he had been with Team USA, and then Andrew Nembhard had a kidney stone. So a lot of the time, they didn't have a ball handler out there. TJ McConnell was having to lift so much of that, and for the many good things that TJ does, the offense is going to run differently with him versus the other two, in part because of how many unders he sees. So offensively, it was a little bit hard to know that this is what was going to come out of the other side of it. But defensively, I had quite a few concerns. So I think over the summer, I had jumped on with Nate Duncan to do the preview pod. And I think I was more optimistic than most and even Vegas, because I thought the Pacers could get to 43 wins. After I had seen in preseason, I was like, wow, I might have been a little optimistic here, given some of what I'm seeing defensively. But then, you know, Tyrese is back in action at the beginning of the season, and they've just been, you know, a house on fire, both with their speed and with what they're doing in the half court, which is a change from last year.
Pacers are first in offense. They are 28th in defensive rating. We will have a discussion about the defense as well on the podcast. We'll start with the offense, and we will start with what Tyrese Haliburton has been able to do. A career year for him so far, pretty much averaging 25 and 12, 61% on twos, 44% on threes on high volume, 93% from the line. 12.5 assists to only 2 turnovers is absurd, to say the least. He has 32 assists and 0 turnovers over his last 2 games, which is equally absurd. First, before you get into the breakdown stuff, how much fun are you having watching Tyrese Haliburton play basketball right now?
I mean, just think about it. These back-to-back against Philly, he threw 149 passes without committing a turnover. And that's with Philadelphia at times really pressuring him full court. That's with him also having to, you know, dribble and do other things. And they're playing at this breakneck speed. And this almost feels like, I haven't really crunched the numbers to see how often this happens, but they're number 2 in turnover rate. And they're number 1 in pace. Like, to be playing that fast and not be turning the ball over, not getting loose with the ball, like, even just looking at teams last year, like Golden State, the Pacers, the Spurs, all played very fast. They all turned the ball over a lot. Like, they were bottom 10 in turnover rate. So the fact that they're able to hold on to the ball while they're advancing it this quickly, like, sometimes they're a 3-man weave drill. They had a possession against San Antonio where they got the ball up the floor in less than 3 seconds and they took 1 dribble. 1. And they're not turning it over. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a fun product to put out there and watch, and just the Tyrese's overall artistry. I think I had a tweet the other day where I was like, never take his ability to pass on the move for granted, where, you know, they're plugging the ball side, hit ahead pass, they're loading to him in transition, and he's using a hop step to get through that. Then he's using a reverse pivot, and in midair, he's still spotting Jalen Smith on the same side of the floor. Like, I think sometimes, like me, I've watched him so much that it's like, I can't write an article about his passing every single day, but you literally could write an article about his passing every single day.
Is he the best passer in the league for you?
I mean, it's probably Jokic, but I think he's 99th percentile easily. And I put both of them right there.
I got you. What would you say has been his biggest area of growth from last year to this year?
Yeah, you guys watched Team USA. I know Steve did. He was doing a lot of clip and film breakdown from that. So during the friendlies, I remember I was thinking, you know, it's not going to be really beneficial for Team USA to play Haliburton and Brunson at the same time, but it could be beneficial to the Pacers for them to play Haliburton and Brunson at the same time. in part because you got to get little glimpses of him playing away from the ball. And I felt during the friendlies that there were some spots that it wasn't great for him. Like Cam Johnson might be dribbling baseline and he wouldn't drift to the corner. Or another guy might be driving to the corner and he wouldn't shake up. And he was kind of hiding himself behind the defense to a degree. I thought that started to turn around in the games that actually counted. And he was also making like extra passes as connective tissue. And now, like, even in the second half of the second game against Philadelphia that counted toward the in-season tournament, Patrick Beverley's pressuring him. They're seeing some face guarding. The Pacers have a couple quick actions that they'll go to in that sense where, you know, it's either wide reject Spain or they'll like reject a stagger and he automatically becomes the back screener, leaks out, gets the ball, makes an extra pass where he's operating. He'll start more possessions away from the ball. And then once he gets back to the ball, he's operating more as connective tissue. So, I mean, I remember at the time I wrote that, like, if he can learn to be a role player, he can be an even better star. And we're seeing him do some role player type things away from the ball. So for me, that's kind of what stood out the most to him. To me, it's not that he isn't still, you know, he's still second in the league in touches. He still has the ball a lot for the Pacers. But in terms of, he doesn't just deactivate when he gets off of it. There's other things that you can do and use him as a screener that we're seeing more of at the beginning of this season than you would have seen last, I feel.
I kind of want to bounce off that and ask you another question, because I think part of the beauty of this Pacers offense, it's not just what Tyrese does. It's not just their pace and their tempo. They've kind of embraced having multiple ball handlers or having multiple people that can initiate sets or keep an advantage with the cutting. How important is it to have the offense go up at the same time that Tyrese is going up and doing different things?
Yeah, I mean, I like that you pointed that out because they actually did have a little bit of trouble in the fourth quarter of the game against Chicago with Alex Caruso guarding Tyrese and pressuring him. And what they'll usually go to in those instances, which is has improved a bit, is Bruce Brown, you know, will be the ball handler and he'll run some pick and roll and they'll run like a Chicago action where instead of just setting the pin down normally, if you can imagine like the person coming up through the middle of the action and then turning back. So it's creating more separation for him to get to the ball with speed. That's what they'll do. And like in that game, they weren't getting into it very quickly or as they would want to. Sometimes the screens were being set too close together, so he wasn't getting separation. But against Philadelphia, they were getting to that. So like that's possible because Bruce Brown's on the roster. It's possible because Andrew Nembhard's on the roster. There were even a couple minutes against Philadelphia where they played Nembhard, TJ McConnell, and Tyrese all at the same time. So I know that, I mean, longstanding now, Rick Carlisle doesn't shy away from having as many playmakers as he can on the court, even if that means you're playing, you know, four players who are all 6'5" and under. They're willing to do that. So it's a big boon when you have a star like Tyrese who's willing to be inclusive and can get off the ball and can do all those things. And like what you just said too, everything they do is at speed, not just in the full court. Them getting into their actions in the half court is quick.
And just to kind of bounce off of both of you, especially with Indiana having the multiple ball handlers, like I think one, that's just what I've enjoyed about watching the Pacers this year. They do play fast, but like anyone can do a little bit of anything within that offense. Like I always point to Andrew Nembhard setting screens, Buddy Hield ghosting screens. He's being the first screener and double drag and stuff like that. On a broader note, like, do you feel like, maybe idealistic isn't the right word, but like, do you feel like the Pacers and like the Thunder are another team that just has anyone can grab and go, anyone can act as a screener, anyone can initiate offense? Do you kind of feel like that's where the league will ultimately end up? Or do you think the Pacers are kind of setting a trend in that regard?
I'm glad that you brought that up because whenever you had sent me this outline about the half court offense, I think that's one of the biggest things that's boosted them for where they were at last year. Some of that was just because Tyrese missed games and that kind of sunk their offense at times. But if you look up on Second Spectrum, they're number one in the league in points per chance out of the pick and roll. And they set more non-contact screens than any other team in the league by a fairly sizable margin per 100 possessions. They're also fourth in guard screens. So it's exactly what you're saying. Like there's a confusion there of will they, won't they? Is there going to be contact on the screen? Are they going to slip out and run out to the perimeter? And when you have somebody like Buddy Hield doing that with what his tension is as a stack screener or when he's just running in front, like this isn't an isolation team. Like the number one way that they get to the next action is with Buddy Hield setting like what I call a reignition screen, but just blurring in front of the ball. And then that connects them to the next play. So, and also just they speed roll a lot. like their bigs don't set a lot of screens. And I know that can be like a source of frustration at times for fans. Like, where is the contact screens? Like, in part, this is why there were calls for Daniel Tice. Cause like he's going to go out there and stick the screen and then he's going to roll. The Pacers really want guys to come up there and do like a touch and go and get out of that pick quickly. Cause they know that there's going to be more attention committing to Tyrese. So they do not set a lot of solid type screens. And this has been something that's really, I feel, has boosted their offense a lot. They're the most efficient pick and roll team in the NBA, and they're getting it with that many different guys setting screens for Tyrese. Several guys have set more than 50 picks for him so far this year.
I'm so glad you hit on the screening point, because I actually wanted to ask you about the screening, because like watching Miles slip out of there or pop out of there, but he's not setting contact. Jalen Smith in particular, he will fly out of there.
Yeah.
And I was wondering like if that was, as someone that is just a stickler with screens, like, I was wondering, okay, how, with the consistency in which both of those guys do that, like, how much of that is intentional within their offense versus a growth area?
There is an intentionality to it, because I know that they like to speed roll. And the other way you can kind of tell how much they value that is when you watch their defense. So, like, just to zoom out a little bit, that, like, Jairus Walker at Houston played in a very aggressive hedge scheme. Jairus Walker has, to him, I feel, pretty good feel as a short roller. And I think in part, that's because his team played a hedge scheme. So he was going against it at practice every day. When you watch the Pacers, they do not want to give up slips in any sense. They are push switching on everything. So, like, if a lot of times when you're guarding a go screen, like, you're going to open your stance and funnel that guy into the next guy. Or you're going to do no screen, no scheme, and you're going to run with the screener. For the Pacers, like if you watch Andrew Nembhard, I call him a ghostbuster because he's really good with this. So he'll be right up contact against that screener, and he makes a gentle nudge to get them to actually set it so that the switch is cleaner and easier to understand. It removes some of the momentum from somebody like Buddy Hield, who's coming at a full sprint. Now, this gets trickier when it's like a 1-5 pick and roll and you want Miles Turner up at the level. They will literally have him nudging that guy to set the pick and clip their own guy, which at times can be like friendly fire, and now you've caused Aaron Nesmith to foul a three-point shooter because you've pushed your guy into him. But I think that those little tiny details show you how much they value slipping out of picks, because they're trying to take it away. Like, they're putting a lot of emphasis to take that away from other teams. Now, are they being successful at taking it away from other teams? We can get into that, but I think that that speaks to how much they value having guys doing that.
On the guard screening front in particular, because I know you watch the team, you cover the team, but like I would imagine you've also had conversations with the staff, or you've been in scrums and things like that. How meticulous are they about draining the guard screening portion of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think another one that I would point out too is when Tyrese made three threes in less than 2 minutes against the Cleveland Cavaliers. And I think Evan Mobley was at the free throw line. You could see Rick Carlisle on the broadcast yelling, like, stay high, Drew, stay high, Drew. And in part, that's Andrew Nembhard. In part, that's because he was being defended by Max Strus during that stretch and Caris LeVert. But he's also very good at a late pivot on a screen. So, like, if he's coming across, like, what we think of, like, Varejão-ing, or, like, what Varejão would do with LeBron, like, coming across to that ghost screen and then flipping sides, so that if Max Strus is going to switch, now he has to switch with the ball moving away from where he is, and it punishes that. So, like, Andrew Nembhard's numbers probably don't jump off the page to everyone this year. He's gotten off to a somewhat slow start as a shooter. He doesn't get to the rim or get a lot of free throws, but there's a lot of little tiny details and nuances to his game that make things easier for Tyrese Halliburton at times. So, yeah, I mean, I think that they definitely want to be using guard screens a lot, and especially, like, you'll hear them talk at the end of quarters too. They want to run 1-4 flat, which is what a lot of teams do, but they're typically putting the guard into the action when they go to the end of the quarter with that.
Got you. Bringing it back to Halliburton then, as we talked about how good he's been, the growth that he showcased, what do you think is the next frontier for him? Or what's the biggest growth area you think is left for him?
I think the biggest thing for him this season, and going back when you look at the film from last season, he needs to get better at hedge and recover, especially in this particular defensive scheme. Like, because they aren't sending as much help to on-ball defenders, he gets targeted quite a bit. So if you're not having to give up those switches, I think that that would help him out and the defense out quite a bit. Because at the end of the Bulls game, the Bulls ran the same play like 5 or 6 times in a row. He was defending Caruso because his best trait on defense is like playing aerial ace, sticking his arms in passing lanes. They started using Caruso to like come off a brush screen out of Iverson and then going and screening for DeRozan so that DeRozan would get Halliburton on an empty side in space, and they ended up flipping Tyrese off of that matchup and putting him on Kobe White. And then Kobe White was like, well, as soon as I make the pass to DeRozan, I'm just going to go screen for him and you're still going to be over there. So they tried to do hedge and recover, but like, I yearn for Tyrese to get one negative dribble when he does this, just like one time divert the ball handler like a little bit. Typically it's more like it's quick and not much show. So he's already done this 13 times this year. All of last year, they only had him in hedge and recover 37 times as the screener because they did so many other things to try to protect him when he was in space, which, you know, didn't necessarily work out super great for them. But like, if they're going to continue on with what they're doing defensively, my number one thing for him is he needs to get better at hedge and recover.
Steve, what would you say? What have you seen from Halliburton? Where would you like to see him grow?
For me, it's just defense. Overall defense. I think he fits in with what the scheme is trying to, you know, as Caitlin said, figure out some of these matchups. Offensively, I'm curious, and I figure I'd ask Caitlin as well, how does he handle if teams are like, hey, man, not you? And so is it going to be a mixture of him off ball? Is he going to have to get rid of it quick and now Indiana plays out of it? They're built to handle that. But at the same part in time, it's always my question mark with a young guard. Is how do you handle that next step of you've arrived? We want you to stop doing that, please. But it's hard to say like there's anything missing from what he's done this year. The control that he displays when he sees space, it's just pick and choose. I can drive right past your drop. I can step back if I want to. He's really commanding the game right now. And combined with how Indiana plays offensively, I think it's just a tough combo.
Yeah, I mean, I think too that like, when you watch that game back against Philadelphia, it wasn't helpful to them that Batum was out and they don't have Oubre, especially with the way Nick Nurse wants to play defense and be creating all these deflections and be playing in the open court more this year than what was the case under Doc Rivers. But they tried a lot of different things against Tyrese that if people had asked me in the past, like, what's the best way to guard him? What would you do? I'd be like, you know, you want to face guard him and what you just said. Like, you want to face guard him and make sure that somebody else is bringing the ball up the floor so it takes longer into the clock for him to get to it. And like, they have like go-to plays where it's like, okay, if he gets top locked or whatever, like I said, like we're just going to have him reject the stagger, go in to be the stack screener, and he'll get the ball back and get loose, make an extra pass. Those types of things looked better in that particular game. And then also like he and Patrick Beverley have a little bit of history, as I'm sure people know. And now two times in a row, he's hit daggers against Patrick Beverley with him weaking him to the left, which is like the book on Tyrese, like weak the pick and roll, send him to his left, because in part, he wants to get to his righty sidestep three. He wants to go right, even though he's a right-handed shooter. And when he gets to his floater, if you weak him, then it's a strong hand contest right on that floater because that's where the body already is. But now, like, he's done this twice now, which is automatic pop and go to the left. Like, one dribble, he's rejecting it, gets to it, shoots it, makes it. Patrick Beverley's been punished for this twice now. So, like, little things that I would have said in the past, like, hey, that's what you want to do. Or, hey, you want to cross match and leave your big in the paint and just use them as, like, a one-man zone. Like, Embiid doesn't really like to get out and contest shooters anyways. But they were doing that. Like when TJ McConnell was in the game, he's like, okay, I'm going to guard TJ McConnell. And then the Pacers were like, okay, well, we're going to use TJ McConnell as the screener. And Tyrese was like, okay, well, I'm going to reject that pick and attack it. And I'm going to find Obi Toppin in the dunker spot. Like he just finds the advantage. Like he has supercomputer tendencies to me with how quickly he's processing stuff right now.
The processing speed always pops for Tyrese. Like obviously you see it with the passing, but even as he's grown as a scorer, like I always go back to something that you pointed out a while ago with, it might not be a pure ISO for him. It may just be a pass receiving. He's gone out of there as a way to create an advantage. And as soon as he senses that he has an advantage, he's getting to a pull up. He's getting to a sidestep. He's making the right pass. He's making a skip somewhere. He's just, well, frankly, he's just one of the best offensive players in the league. But like, I just love how quickly he diagnoses actions. And I think having someone like that at the helm of this offense where it can be as random as it is, like it's such a hand-in-glove fit for what he does and what he brings.
He reads scram switches so quickly. Like, he anticipates that big is going to scram, and he's already throwing that skip pass, like, 30 feet. Like, it's not super effective to even try that a lot of times against the Pacers because he's going to find the person in the corner. Now, maybe you're willing to live with that person in the corner shooting a shot, but he's going to get an optimum shot.
I got a question I want to toss to you. Since we're talking about maybe how do you guard Tyrese or what do you have to do? Does the fact that he's in this offense with their style of play and the amount of possessions they have and the tempo they play with, how hard does that make it to say, hey, this is the one thing we can do? It's like, if you were to think of like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, you'd probably just be like, show help, please, or double. Is there really one thing you can point to because of the way the Pacers play?
Exactly. I mean, that's what Philadelphia was doing. They filtered through so many things. And then the other part of it too is it's exhausting. Like, if you watch Embiid trying to get out and do, like I said, he does a lot of point switching when he's playing in this one-man zone. He's like, okay, now you go switch that, and now you go switch that. And there's a domino effect where eventually he kind of forgets who the original person is that he's supposed to get out and guard. But at the same time, he just looked like he was completely gassed. Like, playing at that breakneck pace, and then you're also having to process different defensive coverages against Embiid, against Haliburton, is a lot to deal with as a defense as well.
I don't think you can really key in on anything. Like, obviously Tyrese is the head of the snake, but again, like, the way that he can shoot, his growing comfort getting downhill, you add in the passing and the fact that he can make just about every pass in the book. Like, you can't really be like, all right, cool, we're just taking him away, we're going to trap every ball screen. Because now he's gotten so good at just rejecting that, stringing it out. He gets rid of it early. And as Caitlin brought up earlier, if you know going in, they're just going to trap him. All right, cool, let's just get him off ball and initiate some stuff. And now you have him attacking a tilted defense, which is a terrifying thought at this stage. I don't really think you can. I think in a broader Pacers context, that kind of brings me to, like, who's going to establish themselves as that true number two alongside him? Because I think, you know, in a vacuum, that's probably what they drafted Benedict Mathurin for. And I think if you look at just the type of player that he is, what kind of driver he is, or has shown to be in flashes at this point, Benedict Mathurin as a guy that can attack a tilted defense, as a guy that can knock down shots, that's not going to be fun to deal with. And even beyond him, just having the amount of guards that you have that can, if you help off a Buddy Hield, he's killing you. Andrew Nembhard, you know, Caitlin mentioned a little bit earlier, doesn't get to the rim all that often, but he does have comfort in the intermediate area. He can get to a floater if necessary. And so, like, I feel like your defense is always tilted against Indiana. And if they do find, like, a true number two alongside Tyrese, I really don't know what you do with this offense.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's the thing, too. Like, I would say, like, pick and roll coverage-wise, probably your best bet is to go weak to switch against him, especially if you're, like, a team with Miami. Like, obviously, Bam is one of one, but that's somebody who gave him trouble last year. He scored 0 points. I think he had one free throw in the game in December. Then he comes back and has 43 and makes 10 threes because he's just hitting the switch pocket. Like, he's just like, I'm just going to pull up from deeper. And when you go to switch, I'm just going to hit that little pocket of space and let the ball go. But also he can attack it from the closeout. So, like, when you bring up Andrew Nembhard, like, when they have so many ball handlers, like, what I would do is just be like, okay, Andrew, like, just when Tyrese gets that switch against Bam, Tyrese, go relocate on the weak side, give the ball to Andrew and have him drive at the big. Because a lot of times the big is going to go help on that drive. Then you give it to Tyrese and you're like, okay, now Tyrese, you attack the closeout against that switch. Like, and that's where, like, continuing to see intermediate steps from Andrew and from Ben is going to be so important from the Pacers this year. Like, some of the stuff that they saw late from Ben against Milwaukee could pay dividends for them, where, like, Tyrese is seeing extra help with the nail and Ben cuts behind that nail help and is able to finish. Or, like, use a stampede cut and he's able to finish. If he can improve at some of that, like, go and catch stuff, I think that could be really big for Tyrese and helping him out.
My favorite part about Indiana, like, the ball movement's great, Tyrese is great, the cutting is great. I want people out there, when you watch the Pacers, see how much time is left on the clock when that ball crosses half court and see how quickly they get into their first action and their second action and the pressure they put on defenses. Made basket, missed basket, you have to get back and guard. And then you have to, like, keep guarding. And that's where I was like, I want to ask Caitlin, like, how much have you seen that part of it grow? Because this isn't necessarily new to a degree, but it just feels more impactful this year to where teams are reacting. And even if they defend an action, here comes the next one. And then here comes the next one. And then, oh yeah, you did switch a small person on Obi Toppin. Let's go ahead and throw him the ball.
Yeah, I mean, that's the randomness, right? So they don't run all the time, like, really nuanced half-court sets. Like, Rick Carlisle is capable of drawing those up. But it'll be like, oh, we're going to run this rifle action or a double drag, or we're going to run our wide reject Spain. They drill 5-on-0 at practices of, okay, we've run this action. What do you get to next? Like, just keep playing random. Get to the next thing. Run your blur. Get the big up and go into split action once if that breaks down. So I think, yeah, I think there's been progress from that early on in the season. And Tyrese even kind of talked about that. I forget after which game it was. And he's like, it could get even more random. Right now, it's just kind of we're leaning on our blurs. We can even take that a step further from where we are right now. So like last year, there was some clunkiness. Like it's a young roster. You're trying to teach guys how to be able to play without having to play out of sets. And now that they've been together a little bit longer, I think that you can see some of that chemistry coming along. And like what you said about where the ball like gets across the half court that early in the shot clock, like one little nuance that I love to bring up about Tyrese is he does not stare down the inbound passer. Like watch him when the ball goes through the net for the opposing team. He is always taking a peek over his shoulder to see where those hit aheads are at before he even has the ball. And also like Milwaukee dropped back into zone against them. So by doing that, he's taking a peek, seeing they're in zone, and then like motioning to Aaron Nesmith, hey, pass the ball ahead. I'm going to let it roll until we get to half court. And now we're still starting this possession at speed because I haven't touched the ball. And now we're going to go into our zone play right off the bat because I've already called it. So like even when they play slow, they're still playing fast.
Such a fun group. Such a fun group. Hey, let's go with the guard group and then transition to Miles Turner and the defense at large. With Benedict Mathurin, hot start to his rookie campaign, efficiency tailed off. This year, haven't seen like the year two jump that a lot of people like to see from the young players. And I was looking at some numbers last night and a little bit this morning. The rate of drives per 100 possession is up for him from last year. His free throw rate and his rim efficiency is down from last year. And I wanted to ask you, Caitlin, as someone who obviously watched him closely, you've also written about him. Is that just early season noise? Do you feel like there's something that defenses are doing differently against him? Is he just pressing? What are you seeing from Benedict Mathurin as a driver? Because that was a real strong suit for him early on in his rookie campaign.
Right. So in August, I wrote a piece about him, and I think I called it like, changes are coming for Benedict Mathurin in year two, where I watched all of the skip passes and kick out passes that he made last year and noticed that he hadn't made any from the left side of the floor with his left hand. And I was like, teams are going to start loading up on him because he is such a powerful driver. And because if he can't move the ball, there's going to be even more incentive to do this. And as it turns out, he has his pass out rate on drives is a little bit higher, and he is trying to make the right play more often. That being said, because of what the shot is after a sample size of seeing him, and there hasn't been like a big jump by comparison to how his shot started out at the beginning of last year, he's seeing a higher rate of shorter closeouts to begin this year than what was the case last year. And then also, like I looked this up on Second Spectrum, he's had 78 drives so far this year, and on 67 of them, there has been a help defender present. So there's still some cases where like he plays against Cleveland and Evan Mobley's rotated to the rim and he's still trying to take that shot. Or like a really big swing play in the game against Philadelphia. Joel Embiid was on the floor. The Pacers had a 5-on-4. Tyrese gave it to Ben in the corner. Bruce Brown was wide open on the strong side corner right next to him. Obi Toppin was wide open in the weak side corner on the opposite side of the floor. He still took that as a drive, and Tyrese Maxey blocked him from behind. So there's still some plays like that where he still needs to get better at processing kickout avenues. I don't think it's so much completely blinders for him anymore as he just doesn't always make the right play. Like when he does see the shorter closeout, you want him to just shoot the shot in rhythm, but he's still very geared to catch and drive as opposed to catch and shoot. So I think that that's led to some of the drop in efficiency on the drives, even though he is still very good at getting to the rim. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a change defensively. And then he's talked about it too. Tyrese has talked about it. The second year is a lot different. He's a starter now. Like he's going against better defenders than what he was a year ago. I think in part that's what helped him last week and against Milwaukee is they've started playing him more with the bench. So originally it was Bruce Brown playing with like Andrew and Buddy and Nesmith and Jalen Smith, and now Ben's doing more of that. So he's playing more at that second unit a little bit more, even though he's still playing as a starter. And I think that that helped him a little bit offensively over that stretch, even though he did have a dip again against Philadelphia.
And you mentioned like him getting the shorter closeouts. Obviously, that's going to be tied into the shot. Do you have a general philosophy on when like defenses shift to, okay, this guy isn't a shooter? Or with a guy that's projected to be a shooter and has a slow start to the career? Like Benedict Mathurin is around, 32, 33% so far. At what point do you get concerned with where the shot is?
The thing is there's times where he's almost looked more comfortable this year with the step back when he's stepping back to his left. And I think in part, like I'd have to ask Steve for his insights when he's watched him. I don't think his shot preparation, I don't think he's always ready to shoot right when he catches it, let alone is he making the quick decision of like, okay, that's a short closeout. I'm going to go right into my shot and shoot. Like when you watched him at Arizona ran a lot of plays for him to shoot off of screens. And it was like, he knew like this play is for me. I shoot. And now with an Indiana's offense, because more of it is read and react, and he's having to make, you know, do more processing to know where his shots are coming from, sometimes he needs like that rhythm dribble to get to his step back in order to get the shot off and make it. And he made some of those against Milwaukee, and he's made some of them lately, but I think it just kind of speaks to that like overall disconnect. I don't think I'm completely out on the shot, but I don't think it's completely where it needs to be, because Tyrese is going to be better off when, you know, he's surrounded by shooters and defenders, to which point Ben has kind of taken, you know, had a little bit of rocky start on both ends in that respect.
You brought up a good point there, which is like processing speed. And I think it's more that than a complete lack of skill. And so when you look at the total picture, he's elevated himself into the starting lineup because of his play. That also means you kind of have to play a little bit different, but not really. But also, like, it might be a cut. It might be a drive. Like, and you can tell when he catches, there's like a hesitation load up. Is this a shot? Is this a drive? It's usually not a hold, which I think is a positive.
Right.
Like, you don't necessarily feel like it's okay. The record's going to scratch. The possession's going to be over when it gets into his hands, which I think is a boost for him. But I'm having a tough time balancing and evaluating that, because I think he's doing a lot of positive things for the team in ways that, where if you have that kind of rookie year, you might expect more shots or more drives or more of this. And it feels like, pick and roll, I'll make a quick decision. And maybe I'll take this shot. Maybe I shouldn't have taken this shot. But I don't necessarily feel like he can't be a knockdown shooter. I think these reps are just ones that he needs to feel the rhythm. Because I feel like of the Indiana guards, this is least like his game, if that makes sense. Just the way that they play.
Yeah. I mean, I pointed that out during preseason, because I think I did like a winners and losers piece, and his first game he had been making, you know, some more passes, and I put that he was standing out by fitting in. Like, he was trying to be more part of a system, and you can still see that. Like, against Philadelphia, the Sixers had cross-matched Embiid on the top end, and then they pre-switched Embiid off and put Maxey on the top, and it's a screener. So when Obi went to go set the screen for Tyrese, they put two defenders on Tyrese. Obi slipped into space, and Tyrese was like, "Oh, okay. They've blitzed me. Obi's open. I'm going to advance this so that Ben can short the roll to Obi." And Ben catches it, and he doesn't even recognize that, and he just quick tosses it to Miles Turner in the corner. So like, he's trying to be part of the system and move the ball and keep it moving. It's just, that's not the right read. And you've lost the advantage that was gained. So I do think that it's an improvement, because I didn't always feel last year that it was like, he was somewhat separatist from the offense. And that's in part how his game is designed, but like, he is making an effort to blend in. It's like we said, it goes back to processing and him making the right decision, not just a quick decision, if that makes sense, to delineate between the two.
Do you think him having, I know you brought it up, but him having some of that second unit run is more of a chance to, hey, go do some of that stuff. Like, do some of that stuff there. They kind of need a little bit more of that. Do you think that could help balance things out?
Yeah, I mean, and I think it helps too, because like, when you swap him and Buddy, like, he's kind of playing with Buddy right now, but like, getting Buddy more reps with Tyrese is good for Buddy and Tyrese, and getting Ben more reps where he can do his own thing is a good thing too. And I don't think that means you have to demote Ben from the starting lineup by any means. I think it's important for the Pacers to be having him out there and getting those reps and developing that stuff with Tyrese. I just think it's been more beneficial for both of them to be getting more run with each of those units respectively, even though it doesn't necessarily look like it in their production against the Sixers. Like, neither of them played super well from a box score standpoint, even though Buddy did end up finishing that game. That was a talking point as well, because Buddy was like 1 of 5 in that last game, and he was in the closing lineup and Ben wasn't. I'm like, well, there's a familiarity between he and Tyrese, and this is, you know, counting towards a tournament. So, and also just like, Buddy doesn't have to shoot well for Buddy to be guarded like a shooter. Like, what you just said before when you asked me that about Ben, like, he's going to have to do some proof of product here in order to get defenders to start guarding him closer. Like, Buddy doesn't have to clear that hurdle. People already think Buddy's going to make a shot even if he hasn't made shots.
He's one of the best to ever do it from the three-point line. Makes sense. On the other end of the floor for Benedict Mathurin, some fun flashes against Milwaukee recently. But as you did mention a little bit earlier, Caitlin, it has been up and down for him defensively. Just what are you seeing from Benedict Mathurin defensively this year?
I felt like that was a really important step forward for him. and in part for the coaching staff as well, because if I was them, I'd be putting that 6 minutes on a loop and showing it to them every day and being like, we know you can do this now. We have seen it. It's documented. Because I'm honest enough to say that I've watched every game he's played and I didn't know he could do that. And I think another important takeaway from it is there should be some schematic takeaways there. Because yes, he took and absorbed bumps from Giannis twice and he got steals, but Bruce Brown was doubling Giannis. Bruce Brown was sitting on the other side of that spin move from Giannis. And when he also prevented Chris Middleton from turning over his left shoulder and getting middle in the lane, Miles Turner was all the way off of Brook Lopez. So I think that there was a little bit of like, hey, maybe we don't need to be quite as dogmatic with some of the single coverage stuff. Because when they played the Hornets, like Gordon Hayward was going at Ben. Like they were running like UCLA cuts into post-ups against Ben, and Ben was getting, he was the one getting turned around and getting lost in those situations, and they were not sending any help. So I think that there should be takeaways from both sides a little bit on what's going to help him and how he can help the Pacers, because they really need him to take a step forward on that end of the floor. And it hadn't happened prior to that game, to be quite frank. I mean, he hasn't really been in the closing lineups. I wrote a piece about him and pointed out that like he was averaging more minutes last year as a bench player in the fourth quarter than what he's averaged so far this year as a starter. Like he hasn't been part of those units. The first game they played against Cleveland, like he was getting cooked early on by Karis. Kind of everyone was getting cooked early on by Karis, but he was really getting hunted. Then they come out in the third quarter and he's guarding Max Strus, and there was literally a possession where he guarded no one for 8 seconds. And then two possessions later, he got back cut by two different players on the same possession. Like he's a guy who he'll have a really strong initial thrust. Like he might really deny a handoff. He'll fight through it. And then it's like, okay, my work is done. Like I've done it. I've stopped this play, and he'll relax. And then that guy just cuts behind him. So it's like, it's getting him to maintain that focus and win. There's a bunch of battles you have to win every defensive possession. They need him to win all of them, not just like make a really big swing for the first half. And then it's like, oh, I've relaxed. And now we've given up a back cut. So like, that's kind of, I think kind of the main hurdle for him is a lot of it's off ball stuff. Like there shouldn't be possessions where, you know, they do a scram switch, which they don't do a lot of, but like they'll do that where Andrew and Aaron will switch a ball screen when Aaron's cross matched onto a five, maybe Jalen scrams out Andrew on that mismatch. And then Ben doesn't know he's guarding to the point where Andrew's shoving him. Like literally pushing him, like there's your guy, like go guard, like that type of stuff. They need him to improve at, especially with where the scheme is currently at.
I guess just to kind of bounce off of an earlier question from Steve, I kind of want to flip it now because it just triggered something in my mind. How difficult is it to defend if you're the Pacers, considering how fast and how random you play offensively, to then have to go on the other end and navigate multiple options from whoever you're facing? And to your point, Caitlin, and we'll get into a broader conversation about the defense shortly, it's not like a lot of help is being sent either. Like, how much strain do you feel is on, like, on Benedict, but I guess just overall, how much strain are on these Pacers to be able to defend in this kind of system?
That's the thing, right? Because, like, earlier when I said, oh, things that I would tell teams to do to target Tyrese are, like, ways to guard Tyrese. One of the best ways to guard Tyrese is to put him into action and to force him to have to guard so that maybe he has a little bit less energy to be pushing the ball as much as he does in transition. So, I mean, I think that there's definitely, like, I don't know where the tipping point of that is. Like, how fast can you play? Like, because sometimes they'll talk about it and be like, if we could get stops, we could play even faster. Like, because we're doing this right now off of makes. Like, that's where they were during exit interviews last year. Like, if we start getting some stops, we could be doing this even more. Like, where's the tipping point at where, like, you, what you just said, where you're doing it so much that maybe it is having a diminishing effect on how much effort you can put out defensively? I don't know that I fully know the answer to that quite yet.
Well, no, I like the question. And I was wondering, like, there are complaints about the Pacers defense, a lot of things that are obvious. But also, that's a lot of, like, possessions that you have to guard because of the way that you play. So you're, like, I feel like you almost curve your grade down to a degree because you might have 7 or 8 solid possessions. That may have just been 34 seconds of basketball, though. So in the grand scheme of thing, I don't feel the impact of your solid defense because, yeah, you might have scored very quickly, but you might have given it right back up. Like, does that make sense? Like, I have a tough time gauging that part of it to where it's like, okay, they can't defend, or it's just not like the meat of their program.
we need to have like a per 75 possession stat for the Pacers defense. just to see like what the curve is. Like, oh snap, okay, they've hit the 82nd possession midway through the third.
And I mean, for how much emphasis and how much they've changed the scheme, they certainly think that it matters. They certainly want to get improvement on the end of the floor. My bar for them is I just need them to be merely bad. If they can get to merely bad, I think this could be a very good basketball team. But right now, they have not reached the benchmark of bad. They are still below bad, in my opinion.
Ooh, let's. I want to talk about defense. I know you want to kick it all off, right, guys, because my brain in that Pacers-Sixers little two-game series they had was, boy, they got carved up by Maxey and Embiid, empty side pick and roll. Oh, they made the simple adjustment of having one person show help on Maxey and Embiid's side pick and roll. And that's where I was like, well...
Okay,
it's true. Like, they opened that first game. Like, let's just start right there, because that really is a great place to start this conversation. So the Sixers opened that game. That's the very first play of the game, like a basic UCLA cut, giving the ball to Maxey at the wing and then going into empty side pick and roll. Bruce Brown's guarding Maxey. Miles is guarding Embiid, and it's 2 versus 2. So they ran that play on, I think, 5 of the first 6 possessions of the game, and they scored points on it every time, except for the fact that, like, I will give the caveat that one of them was a putback from Embiid. But in part, like, they give up a lot of mismatches by doing this because they late switch. So schematically, what they do is there is a very finite trigger in that if the ball breaks the free throw line, they want the on-ball defender to veer switch, get into the legs of the roller, and then the big is supposed to absorb the ball. They were having a lot of problems with that. And, like, let's just be honest. Like, I looked up on Second Spectrum. Like, Maxey and Embiid so far this season has been number 2 in the NBA on empty side, empty corner actions in terms of points per yield. But against the Pacers, they scored 1.33 points out of empty corner actions in that game. That's an absolutely absurd number. Like, that's basically them scoring almost every time, except for they did get a couple stops in the second quarter. But yeah, I mean, I went through, Nikias brought up the video, I went through and looked around at how some other teams guarded it, and Boston was pretty much icing everything. And then I looked at how the Raptors were guarding it, and they were letting Scotty do a lot as a roamer. So they would have him come off Tobias Harris, be at the nail early, and then as soon as Embiid got it in the post, they were having him come over and double. The Pacers weren't sending any help, and, like, they generally don't. Like, they want to guard these 2 versus 2 because they want to limit 3-point attempts, which they are doing. Like, they're allowing the lowest rate of above-the-break threes in the NBA. They're 2nd on corner threes. They gave up a lot of corner threes last year, so they felt like they were very overzealous with the low man at times, which I can see and agree with. But, like, I guess I'll throw it to you guys a little bit, and I can set the stage here and say that watching that game against Philadelphia, by comparison to watching them play the first game against Philadelphia last year, will give people who may not watch the Pacers a lot a very clear picture of how much the scheme has changed. So, like, James Harden was obviously still on the team, but, like, they would switch if they got Jalen Smith on a switch against James Harden or any unfavorable switch, they would automatically have somebody at the nail even before he put the ball on the floor. Like, as soon as that switch happened, it was like emergency help at the nail, and the Sixers scored 19 threes in that game. And James Harden also got his numbers as well. So part of the problem was, when you looked at it defensively, is they would do a lot. So they were very aggressive, heavy nail presence. They would have the low man coming over early. If Tyrese got an unfavorable switch, lots of help shrinking the floor behind him. They did a lot of peel switching. They used Miles as a roamer because they had to, because the floor was smaller. But then when you look at the numbers, like, none of that matched what they were doing. So they were still giving up tons of rim frequency, a lot of points in the paint. So, I mean, to a certain extent, you look at it and be like, okay, well, they were using all these protections last year and they're still getting beat. And, oh, by the way, they're still giving up a lot of corner threes. Now, I think the thought process is, like, we want to teach this mentality. We're hoping it'll be a slow build and people will get better on ball. And at least we're holding down the 3-point line. Like, that's the charitable way of viewing this, I think. Like, that's kind of... The only problem is that they just don't have the on-ball defenders, I feel, and the people in the post to necessarily warrant this, which is why, you know, Giannis scores 40, and then they're having to hard trap because they don't have a choice. Or, like, they have to go into the second game against Philly, and like Steve just said, they made the massive adjustment of putting somebody at the nail. And their defense did get better on those actions by doing it. So it's kind of like, little by little, I think they're kind of finding out, like what I said earlier about Ben defending Giannis. They still need help. Like, this roster still requires help, even whether you're doing it or not. Like, they still need it.
I think for me, like, there has to be some sort of middle ground. Like, I do understand the logic of, for lack of a better way to phrase it, simplifying things defensively. It's like, okay, y'all just need to get better. We don't want to, and I guess it's like the old adage of we have to take away something. To your point, Caitlin, we can't be flying around and we're like 28th in rim rate allowed and we're also bleeding threes at the same time. It can't be both. And so I do commend them for at least saying we're not going to give up the threes at least. But I do think, one, your personnel is an issue, so there's only going to be so good your defense is going to be. But you do have a lot of speed on the floor. Like, I do think I would rather them lean into more of the help, even if it isn't as aggressive as it was last year or in years prior. I think you do have to lean into the help a little bit more. If you're going to be this small, inherently you're going to have some speed on the floor. Trust your guys to start getting into help positions earlier and then scrambling back out of there. And even if you're just going to go with hard closeout and run guys off the line that way. Like, I would almost prefer that versus just leaving your guards out to dry.
You know, bouncing off what y'all said, I feel like there's a weird combination of things for Indiana that is causing a disconnect defensively, because they have some guys who can do the defensive things. They want to be less aggressive to a degree. There's a play when they played Utah that stands out in my brain. I pulled it back up while y'all were talking.
It when Tyrese wouldn't let them scram him out?
Mm-mm. Wasn't that one, because that was a plus. This was very early on. It's just a dribble handoff from Utah. Indiana switches. But Bruce Brown and Benedict are so far off the ball that you're not actually there, even though you did a good job, right?
Yeah.
And now you fly off a pick and roll, and Miles Turner is kind of there, but he's dropping back. And the defense is in perfect help position at the elbows. The only problem is they were in way early, and now it's just a fired skip pass to Lauri Markkanen, and he hits a three. And in my head, I'm like, y'all did so many good things there, but you also didn't impact Utah one single bit. And I'm trying to figure out how to process that. And it's like, is it just because there's no ball pressure? Is it because Miles Turner is, as Caitlin pointed out, pushing his man up? So he's not necessarily impacting the ball. Like, is it just as simple as, can they impact the ball more and this will pop more? Because it's like, do you have the screen navigators? Is your size well enough? Like, I don't know. I'm throwing it out there.
I think that what I would say about that is, and I'll tread lightly here, because Miles Turner is a tremendous rim protector. We know what his defensive impact numbers are. He's worn a lot of different hats defensively. What Nakai has said is they were trying to do a lot of different things, and this overall is simpler, although some of them have said, like, I know Bruce Brown kind of made a comment of like, this is different than what I've done before. Like, I haven't done this at other stops. Mm-hmm. Miles has done a little bit of everything from, you know, Frank Vogel to Nate McMillan to Nate Bjorkren's like 10 schemes at once to what they've done the last couple years, trying to take on lots of different identities. But I think if they had their druthers, it would be better to have Miles as a weak side guy defending pick and rolls. And that would not have been my opinion a year ago, because that's not something they've ever really had him do. And there was a point in time where, like, he could defend an empty corner action and he could swallow it up. I'm not sure that that's still this, because I think a lot of times defensively we think of defenses of like, you know, who's the weakest link? Who's going to get hunted? Sometimes I think for the Pacers, you have to look at that as a strongest link thing. And I don't know that he on his own is capable of buoying this scheme. Like, that a rim protector kind of league-wide, can a rim protector be your strongest link anymore? I don't necessarily know. Like, last year they were using him in the weak side role, and I was able to explain it because, like, they're playing four guards. They have to have his passive size around the rim. People can't stay in front of the ball. Now it's like, you'll watch them play Boston, and when Porzingis and Horford were both on the floor, Miles is on Horford and Aaron is on Porzingis to keep Miles from defending in space against Porzingis. And this is at the same time when Bruce Brown and Nembhard on the floor. So, like, you can't be like, oh, this is because of the, you know, the leaky guard defense. Like, no, this is more about, like, what role is better for Miles at this point. The problem is like, if Horford's not on the floor, you can't do that scheme. Because who is Miles guarding? Like, you're not putting Miles on Derek White. You're not putting him on Jaylen Brown. You're not putting him on Jason Tatum. Like, there's not an option. So, in certain matchups, this works. And I think it works well for Aaron to be cross-matched against a five and then just switch those ball screens. And then you can have Miles protecting the rim and help versus doing like the late switching and the nudging up at the top of the key. I think if it was up to them, they would like to be able to feasibly do that. But you can't really do that with Obi Toppin as your starter. Like, you're not putting Obi Toppin on a five and having him switch out to like Darius Garland or Donovan Mitchell, like those types of matchups. So they kind of have to balance a couple different schemes. But I think overall, like to my eye test, it looks better when they're doing that. It's just not viable against every matchup.
That's interesting. And I was looking at Sega's Fetch a little bit earlier, just some of their basic like drop rate, switch rate, stuff like that. They're dropping a lot more this year than they were last year. Switch rate's down over 8%. Blitz rate is also down. So that kind of goes into they're trying to simplify things. But like, yeah, like maybe cross matching would be more of an answer. But again, they even ties into the personnel point and something that you said a little bit earlier, Caitlin, like you just want them to be bad versus where they are now. Like, do you feel like the cross-matching gets them too bad versus this? Or is there even more that you think should be done there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's too that, like, are you in 13? Are you in 14? Are you in 15? Like, they can't do this with all of the different people. So it's like, over the summer, when you add Jairus Walker, who isn't clearly in the rotation, when you add Bruce Brown, like, they did add defenders, but you can't really be playing all of your, like, they don't often put all of their defenders on the floor at once. Like, you're not often playing a lineup that has Nembhard and Bruce Brown and Nesmith and Miles Turner and TJ McConnell or whoever you think the other best fifth person is. Like, they don't always get to those combinations. So, like, I like the cross-matching. It was almost a blessing in disguise, like, not to degrade the bigs, because I think Miles and Jalen have had tremendous starts to the season. But when they got into foul trouble against Embiid and they put Aaron on Embiid, that was, like, watching those minutes, you would not think that they should be able to win those minutes. But when they're forcing Embiid to run and what they can do offensively against him, and then when you're fronting him, I'm kind of surprised that more teams aren't trying guards on Embiid, to be honest, besides just Drew and Aaron and OG Anunoby, because he can't run delay at that point. Like, you're taking that away from the big. Like, you're not going to have a big handling up top and doing side-to-side stuff if Drew Holiday's guarding him or if Aaron Nesmith's guarding him. So that forces them into the post. And then in that particular matchup, the Pacers were a little bit more willing to double. So they were like doubling him when he didn't even have the ball. And like, this is what both of you kind of got at, that I think some of it's just about being less dogmatic with it. So like a team against like Philadelphia, that's not a quick trigger shooting team. Like, they have a lot of guys who are going to catch the ball and second guess whether they're going to shoot. Like, they're not going to let it go right away. So if you want to bring help off of Tobias Harris or some of their other shooters, you're generally okay with that. Maybe that's not okay against every opponent. But in this one, maybe we're all right if we put more help at the nail. Maybe we're all right if we're more aggressive with the doubles from the very get-go, because we know we don't have guys who can handle this in a two-on-two setting.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Steve, do you have further thoughts on what Indy's doing base-wise?
I wonder if they can advance into, okay, we're bothering you. We're taking something away. You can feel our defense. Because I don't even know if it's purely positional, because I think they stay in front. They communicate. They switch. They're active. It's just, if you're playing that far off a guard, they can lead the dance. If your pick and roll coverage is Miles eventually kind of containing, but being in two-on-two, offenses are leading the way. So it's like, okay, do you establish this base and now graduate to, we're taking this away? Like, for me, if by the end of the season I can just point at one thing that Indiana's bad at, that's a win for them defensively. Like, if I could just say, hey, this scheme doesn't work, or this lineup doesn't work, or it's just closeouts. Right now it just kind of feels unbalanced where, hey, this is really good activity. Oh no, you got beat. Oh, now here comes the help. Oh, now you're in rotation. Ah, good switch. Wait, Miles is dropping back. Oh, that was a quick pocket pass. Oh, no. Those kind of ones where it's just like the wheel of errors to a degree.
And that's part of it, too, because they don't want to put themselves in rotation. Like, they were doing that a lot last year. And then part of it, too, is they're trapping or doing some half-court trapping sometimes against wings because they don't have anybody to guard them. And then they don't really have the size on the backside of the traps either. So the element of this is last year they were dead last in offensive rebounding rate. And like, when you're constantly trapping and having to scramble, you're making your rebounding more vulnerable. So they have gotten a little bit better in that particular aspect. Although I would say that, like, when you're doing this much late switching and, you know, people are veering into bigs, you're automatically giving them a little bit of an advantage on the glass right next to the rim, if that's where the ricochet goes. But that aspect of it has gotten a little bit better. But like, to your point in saying that about letting the guard lead the dance, they use the word disposition a lot, that like our disposition needs to be better. Like we need to impact that. Like it wasn't just only that they sent the nail help, although I think that's a big part of it. They also were more and playing closer to the ball and getting up in it to try to impact that. So I think that that's what they're hoping for, that there can be a slow build that like, hey, we're doing this. And because we aren't giving you tons of help, like it's kind of exposing you. And like, maybe as the year goes on, like there's little incremental things that we can point to, like with Benedict Mathurin, and be like, hey, that was a growth step for him against the Milwaukee Bucks. Now we just need more of those as the season goes on. I think some of it, like they obviously want to build a mentality. They want to pursue. They don't want to peel. They want, like when I brought up that play of Tyrese, like that was a moment for him. Like they don't want to do a lot of scram switching and triple switching. So he gets on an island against Kelly Olynyk, and Miles was actually like yelling like, hey, I got you. I'm going to scram you out. And Tyrese was like, no, like I'm going to swim the post here and I'm going to stand here and try to take this mismatch, which like people saw what happened in Team USA a lot of times when he and Austin Reaves are getting targeted and Steve Kerr didn't want to do scram switching with them. So like to see him stand there and do that, like that actually was a moment for him. So whether that can hold up over the full season against everybody in the post, I don't know. But like that's what they're trying to get. That's where they're trying to get, I should say.
And just very quickly circling back to Miles, if we can, we talked a little bit about his usage. If they're not going to play Stash him weak side and have a smaller guy on Embiid, like, are you a fan of Miles just kind of up to touch? Or would you prefer to have him in a deeper drop to protect from some of those rim attempts? Or how do you feel about just his general pick and roll usage, if this is what they're going to?
It's a delicate balance because, like, I don't even know how Second Spectrum's tracking it, because technically, like, it probably isn't to term up to a touch because he is still in back pedal. But it's like he is at the level, he puts his hand literally on the screener and they want him to nudge that guy to make contact and set that screen because they don't want to give up the quick out. But again, the timing has to be right and it depends on who the screen navigator is to a degree, because like if it's Andrew Nembhard, like, okay. If it's maybe sometimes TJ McConnell, okay. But like if you're pushing the guy, like I said, there was a moment, I believe, against Chris Middleton against the Bucks where Miles used the little nudge and his defender ran into Aaron Nesmith, and then Aaron Nesmith fouled Chris Middleton on a three-point shot. Like, so I think generally he's probably a little bit better if he can stay behind the ball and the roller than having him up high. But there has been times, like there were times against the Sixers where they blitzed Tyrese Maxey a couple times with him. I guess in that setting, I'm a little bit different from what they're doing this year, because I actually liked, like, if you're going to blitz with Miles, I liked that they would switch with the low man. So the low man would step up and like take Embiid, and that's a switch. And then Miles just runs to the nearest guy on the perimeter instead of expecting Miles to come and run and get back in front of the guy that's slipping out of the pick. But they don't want to do that because they want to teach everybody that like we defend individual matchups. We take pride in this. We're pursuing. But I think like in today's NBA, I just think that there's a lot of utility from peel switching in terms of taking like advantage of kinetic energy. And in part, this is why like we don't use choppy feet on closeouts anymore, because it's just, it's better to be at full speed and just let that momentum ride. But we'll see. Like they have been willing to adjust things. Like I think that that does speak well of them, that it hasn't been complete stubbornness with all of this. Like in that Bucks game, they did start to up the pressure. They did start using some half court trapping against the Sixers from game one to game two. They didn't defend those pick and rolls exactly the same way and expect to get different results. So I think this coaching staff in general has been fairly good at being self-reflective and being like, this is what works, this is what doesn't. So if it continues to stay exactly as it is, I would expect that they tinker.
All right, let's go a little rapid fire through some of the new guys, some of the bench as well. You talked a little bit about Bruce Brown and some of his comments about the defense. Just in general, how have you felt about the Bruce Brown fit in Indiana so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's starting to come together. Like, obviously, he's not going to shoot the ball as well as he did in the very first opener, where he made more threes in that game than he ever has before in his career. I wondered if he, like, wanted to cut out that box score and send it to Calvin Booth after Calvin Booth had that comment in the Ringer about, like, hey, good luck with that guy, more or less, or whatever. That's paraphrasing. That's not what he really said. But, yeah, I mean, I think overall, like, he's not being used. It's kind of a mixture between Brooklyn and Denver, right? Like he's not being used as a roller like he was in Brooklyn, where like he's being defended by the weakest guy and he's actually like operating as a center. But there are places within Indiana's offense where like they run C, which is like a corner play where the guy in the corner comes up and sets a touchscreen. Like he does that a lot, and then that gives him an opportunity to slip into space. And then also you can put him on ball, like what he was doing with the Nuggets, where like he was more of a ball handler and doing more in transition and using some of his finishing moves in transition. So it's been kind of a nice little mix. And then just having him, like despite what the coverage was on those empty ball screens, it helps them to not have to do that with Benedict or Tyrese. It helps that the two of them aren't having to take that responsibility and that he is somebody that you can throw out there and do it in addition to having Andrew Nembhard and Aaron Nesmith off the bench. So like I liked that signing when it happened, and I don't think I've changed my opinion so far from what I've seen of him.
Okay. Steve, are you also there with the Bruce Brown signing? What have you seen?
Oh, I've liked it. I think his skill set fits what Indiana wants to do, probably a little bit better than I anticipated because of the pace they play. But because he was not just a guard last year. Yeah, he can do a whole lot of the guard stuff, and he has the freedom to do it. So I think that's a plus. Are you intrigued to see him used more as a screener or in different ways as the season goes on?
Yeah, I mean, I think he actually has set almost as many picks for Tyrese as Buddy has.
Hey,
like they will use him. Yeah. Like they, I mean, there's just so many places during with various sets, and they're not afraid to mix up combinations out of double drags and staggers about who the screeners are there too. I mean, even just like seeing him be the person running, like I did not expect last over the summer when I wrote my piece about him in free agency that we would see late in a game against the Sixers that he's the ball handler and Tyrese is a stack screener. That's not something I anticipated, but it's helpful depending upon what certain defensive combinations are and who's guarding who. So I just like how much versatility he offers you that you can move him around a lot.
Got you. With Obi Toppin coming into play, making that trade, I was excited. It's like, okay, he's going to get to play in this up-tempo system. He's going to catch some lobs. This should be a lot of fun. Defensively, we shall see. What were your expectations of Obi in Indiana, and how's that kind of matched what you've seen so far?
Oh, I'm throwing the hockey assist to Steve. He said he has a lot of Obi thoughts, so I want to get his thoughts on what Obi Toppin has been with the Pacers.
Oh, I'll go first. I want to apologize to Obi Toppin and the Pacers. I was down a little bit because I was like, why are we keep talking about Obi Toppin as a roller when we ain't never seen him roll? And guess what he's been? Rolling. The other thing, I cannot unsee Obi Toppin's cutting. When I watch the Indiana Pacers, I cannot unsee how much cutting he does and the timing he does it with. As far as just, oh, cool, we're bringing up a transition, I'm trailing the play a little bit, zoom right down the right wing. Not only am I clearing space, you don't know where I'm going. This is timed really well. So yeah, you might want to help off me on the weak side. I just got here. The ball's already over there. So now what? I think the gap play, the glue stuff, some of the drives he's done, but just watch it. Watch him cut. Watch him cut when you watch the Pacers. I just want to make sure I point that out and apologize because I think he's done a lot of good things for Indiana. I think he's been more active offensively than I had anticipated. And salute to Obi Toppin.
I mean, something that you've pointed out in your threads whenever I've watched you cover the Spurs games, this was a big thing. Everything you just said played out pretty well against the Spurs because Wemby takes up a lot of space on the weak side, right? So when they're playing the Spurs and they're running pick and roll action, Wemby was guarding Toppin. So he was pretty much like wherever Tyrese was and wherever the ball moves, he was going to cut opposite of that to constantly be moving him out from being able to use his massive wingspan at the nail or being able to be used as the low man. They were constantly using picks for him to cut in and around the pick and roll in that game. So like he had a good scoring outing, but some of it is just more so too, just how he's moving the help with his movement. And then in the game against Philly as well, everything you just said there too, like when the ball gets dribbled towards him, he automatically cuts toward the basket. So like when the ball is coming in transition, he's cutting around the backside of that. He's crashing hard for lobs. And obviously Tyrese's ball placement on those is really special. So I anticipated, like I felt like going from New York's pace to this pace and having somebody to run pick and roll actions with him and also playing with a big who wasn't going to be in the dunker spot, like what Mitchell Robinson is a lot of times, would open stuff up for him. And I think some of it's been a little bit up and down, but I think overall, like what he just did against the Sixers, that was by far his best game since he's come over from the Pacers. And I don't know that you always want him in the closing lineup. They clearly don't. Like most of the time it's Aaron at the four and a lot of closing lineups for defensive purposes. But I think that that's what stands out too the most. Like when you look at just his numbers, like a lot of it is coming off of cuts.
Let's get into Aaron really quickly. Fresh off of the new extension he earned with his play at Indiana once he got there after the trade. The defensive utility for him is fun. I can't say it's something that I expected for him to have to defend up as much as he's had to in Indiana, which, again, feels like a broader like roster construction thing with Indiana. But how have you felt about the offense from him?
To start the season, it's been better. He talked about at Media Day that he knew, which is ironic now, because he was like, going into this season, I thought I was going to be playing at the three. So playing at the three means I'm going to be above the break more. I'm going to be doing more as the blur, like the ghost screener, and be playing out of those types of plays. So I need to be able to put the ball on the floor. So during preseason, he hits like several pull-up twos against Houston, coming out of just like wide action and getting downhill off of screens. Now he hasn't been doing as much of that because they've been playing him at the four again, but you are seeing him attack corners more, and like he's never been like a quick rip guy from a standstill, but like against the tilted defense and when he's coming off a blur, he's been putting the ball on the floor a little bit more. He's been doing it from the left side of the floor in the left corner, like especially against Cleveland, which isn't something that you normally would have seen. And obviously he's just shooting the lights out of the ball right now. I don't know that he's going to continue shooting 45% from three, but it's definitely been welcome that he's currently shooting 45% from three in addition to what he brings defensively. So I think he's been definitely a bright spot to start the season. I was in favor of signing him to the extension. So
he's been a lot of fun. And like, I guess I look at him, I look at some of the guys that Andrew Nembhard had to defend last year and still has to defend this year. Bruce Brown coming in. It just feels like Indiana has a lot of players kind of having to punch above their weight defensively. And so like, I admire that, but I also, a long running joke with Steve and I with like Royce O'Neal when he was in Utah, it's like, I love what you do defensively. I don't like that you have to do all of this defensively. Yeah. Like, it would be cool if you were like defender two or defender three. It's like we feel as great about this as we should. But no, I've really enjoyed the Andrew Nembhard experience so far. In the guard room still, Buddy Hield, he's now been there for a little bit now. Has the passing surprised you? Because it surprised me when he first got to Indiana. Like, I know just basic box score, that was the early stretch where he was after like five or six assists. I'm like, wait a minute, this has never been Buddy Hield. But, like, has that part of the offense surprised you at all in addition to what he does as a shooter and as a screener?
There was moments in preseason, Nikias, where they only had TJ McConnell available as a point guard. So we're running point Buddy. And there was literally a sequence where he was a secondary rim protector, got a stop, brought the ball up the floor, and, like, thread a wraparound pass in transition. Did I see that type of a thing happen? No, I did not. Like, his secondary skills definitely popped as soon as he came over. And I think in part it's because the Pacers had more shooting, so he's not running into gap help as soon as he puts the ball on the floor. But he's pretty decent, like, throwing like an overhead pass when the big commits to him to throw that up over the top of the defense. He's done more of it. Like, I don't want him doing a ton of dribbling or having to self-create in order to make the passes, but because his shooting is what it is, he doesn't necessarily have to. Like, that they commit to him enough that he can just, like I said, he can just throw it up over the top. So I think that's been pretty nice to see, and he just fits really well within a Rick Carlisle offense and with all the randomness. So, like, I don't know where his head will be at in free agency, but I think that in a lot of ways, like, he probably means more to the Pacers than he would. He might be more valuable to the Pacers than another team because he does fit so well with Tyrese, because he is so good at staying on balance in transition as a shooter, because some of his secondary skills can pop in the system because of the other people that are out on the floor with him. I've enjoyed the Buddy Hield experience more than I thought that I would when that trade happened. Like, I kind of just looked at it at the time of like, this is the matching salary to get Tyrese here. And like, it'll be nice over the back end, because when you do have a young developing roster, it's good to have shooters. It's good to have those guys to be able to have spacing and stretch their legs around them. So I didn't think it was a negative thing, but I've enjoyed having him on there. And I think that there are things that he does that makes the team better. So even though he hasn't shot the ball quite as well to begin the season and isn't playing as many minutes with Tyrese, which might have something to do with that.
Makes sense. A quick free throw for the both of you then. A better passer, Buddy Hield or Duncan Robinson?
I'm saying Buddy. Well, I don't know. I do like what Duncan can do when he gets trapped off a dribble handoff.
I'm going to go Buddy right now. Duncan's going to have to do it a few more, a couple more weeks, Duncan. I'll think about it.
I'm glad it didn't immediately get laughed off the pod. I did my job. Caitlin, you mentioned a little bit earlier that Jalen Smith has gotten off to a really good start, and he has popped off the page for me, at least offensively he has. What exactly have you seen from Jalen this year?
Jalen is the best three-point shooter in the NBA. He has the highest effective field goal percentage in the NBA. I mean, there's a point where, like, last year he was starting at the four, and it was no longer viable to do that because so many opponents were cross-matching Miles. Like, they went on a 7-game road trip, and it really kind of plummeted their offensive rating to a point where when they came back, it wasn't too long after that that Aaron became the starter. Obviously, he's added a lot of muscle during the offseason, and sometimes muscle wash can get overrated, but he is playing with more force. Just like setting seal screens, you can tell that he's more solid. But in addition to that, he's just overall playing with more force. Like, he's making harder rolls. If he sets a screen, he actually does slip. He actually does roll. I don't think his hands are always great at catching tough passes, but he's done a lot of things. And like, when Miles and Jalen are shooting the ball out of the pop like they are, and I don't know if they'll continue to shoot this hot, but like, imagine them playing the Hornets and Jalen's popping off an angle pick and roll and Buddy's adjacent to them. Like, that's like a cheat code right now, especially when Tyrese is using his eye manipulation and getting that defender to run at Jalen. Like, they're to the point where they're starting to get, like, I say this a lot with stretch fives, that rim protectors don't always come out and commit to the five. Like, it's more about the positioning. Like, yes, it opens the driving lanes because there aren't bodies there, but I think most of the time, like, those are kind of free points, but they actually are drawing like some weak side help to the point where like, Brooke Lopez got like visibly angry in the one game they played against Milwaukee because somebody didn't go over there to contest Miles. And like, it kind of helps too that when Jalen is popping like he is, that both units can play somewhat similarly, because Jalen and Miles do play similarly in how they operate out of the pick and roll. So like, I think, you know, Jalen out and out won that spot. I don't know that they would have played Daniel Tice anyways because of the timeline issues, but like, Jalen was that good in preseason that he deserved and earned getting to play. So
I have a Jalen Smith question, honestly, based on something you said. Do you think the defensive scheme is also to allow them to be consistent throughout units between Miles and Jalen?
The interesting thing is Jalen can probably do a little bit more switching than Miles can. Like, there was a moment in the game against Utah where he like stopped an initial push from Colin Sexton in transition and then also stopped the re-attack from Colin Sexton in transition. I feel sometimes in drop, like, if you're a screener who really sprints into the screen, Jalen will trail behind it and then he's going to be late, and then like LaMelo might, you know, split between him. He's not to Miles to that extent, but like, yeah, I think that there can be, like, I think that that's helped them on both ends of the floor, that they do play somewhat similarly.
That makes sense. And just to quickly put some numbers on the Jalen Smith start, 11.6 boards for him, 67% on threes on, don't ask me about the volume though.
He's the best three-point shooter in the NBA, Nikias.
He's the best three-point shooter in the league. What you got, Nikias?
False, we did. We did it. 72.5% on twos. He's been insane. And it's also just been cracking me up as I've been doing like the screen time series for the 342 newsletter, and just seeing like the screen contact stats between him and Miles. I feel like I've indirectly mentioned them back to back. Like, oh, well, here's your best screener in terms of points per chance in the league this year. However, this contact, though, is really low. But this is why I'm glad we had you on to have the conversation about how they're teaching that. So that's been fun. It's way too early for actual playoff talk. But I guess just projecting ahead, if the Indiana Pacers do stay at the top 6 seed or a top 4 seed, are there any matchups you like for this Pacers team with their chances to win a first round series? Or do you feel like the defense is at a point to where you can't get there right now?
It's interesting because like in the in-season tournament or like in a play-in tournament, I think that like in a one-game setting, the Pacers could be a scary team for a lot of teams because they can get up, and because so many different people could have a good night for them where they're kind of hard to game plan against. In a series, like I mean, they just gave up 154 points to Boston. I don't know that I lean very heavily on that one because like I just pointed out, like defensive scheme wise, it makes it very hard for them to do any type of cross matching because I don't know where you would put Miles in that type of a scenario. The Philadelphia matchup was better than I anticipated it being, but I don't know that I think Philadelphia's roster will stay exactly as is. I feel like they will probably make another move, but right now, like as strange as it is, because as Embiid has said, he has, you know, casually dominated that matchup for a long time. I actually probably like that a little bit better than what it would be against the Bucks or what it would be against Boston if we're projecting them as the top teams in the Eastern Conference.
Got you. Well, as we check the stand recording on a Thursday afternoon, the Thursday slate hasn't happened yet. Miami, Indiana, and Milwaukee are all 7-4, so they're in that 3-5 range. Brooklyn is sixth, And so if we get like a 3-6 Indy Brooklyn first round, like that gets interesting to me.
It's an interesting stylistic clash. I'm like, I love the matchups between the Pacers and the Knicks and some of the back and forth that's been in those games, like, and just the history between the two teams. Like, I think that would be super fun. The matchup between Cleveland's also been kind of interesting to watch from the first game to the second one and how they've navigated some of that. So I'm looking forward to it. Like, I would love to cover playoff basketball again. Let me tell you, I haven't covered the Pacers winning a series since 2013. So it's been a while.
We got to get the Pacers in the playoffs for Caitlin. Also, we need the Caris LeVert revenge series just to
LeVengeance.
LeVengeance.
Friends, we did it. We did it. Okay. One last question for you, Caitlin, as we get ready to close this out. Where can the people find your work?
My Twitter handle is at C2_Cooper. It's not a good handle, but there's literally like 200 Caitlin Coopers on X, Twitter, whatever we're calling it. So I had to come up with something. Then if you go there, there's the link to my Patreon, patreon.com/basketballsherote is where all of the content is. I do a monthly mailbag over there, and I've been trying to toy around with some video breakdowns. Hopefully people like the one I did about the Sixers. So
yes,
we'll see if I do more of those throughout the year or not.
I mean, based on the comments, the people are clamoring for it. So, I mean, and in my unbiased opinion, I would like to see more of those because you're really freaking good at them. Steve, any closing Pacer thoughts for you?
Nah, it's been a fun start.
Do you have an opinion on whether jump passes are good?
I think they're good.
I think they're good now.
I think they're good for most people. There are some people who need to not venture there. But, you know, gray area. Let's let people have fun. I think the Pacers have been fun. I think the most important thing is they're winning while establishing their culture so you can get more buy-in, you can reach ahead. And so if we're talking playoffs, if you're in that mix, it's better than being lower and trying to climb your way up, and now you have to deal with maybe a play-in game and then Boston. So I'm intrigued. Does this become a thing where, oh, we've won, oh, this is tough? Because they're a tough team to deal with in the regular season no matter what. But, hey, we're the 3 seed, you know, and now all of a sudden there's belief and vibes and like, okay, Knicks, Hawks, you want to play? That's fine. We can win a series. That's where I'm intrigued.
Yeah. I got you. Like, it's just been fun watching this team play on a very basic level. Like, the style of offense, Tyrese has been awesome. I'm really enjoying it. I do want to see what adjustments are made defensively throughout the year. Because again, I do think there's just a ceiling with the current personnel right now. So I'm not making any bones about that. But I do think if they do tweak some things with how much they want to help and stuff, like, I think you could go see them jump from 28th to like 22nd, 21st, somewhere in there.
That's
and I think
my that goal. Becomes a lot merely bad.
There you go. It becomes a lot more viable. And just in terms of early success, like, this isn't new. Before Tyrese got hurt last year, they were top 4, top 5 seed. So it's not like they haven't showcased that they can win regular season basketball games when they are right. And so if this team stays healthy, it's hard pressed to see them falling completely out of the picture. Like, I think they're just going to be here, knocking on wood for good health. So shout out to the Pacers. Thank you, Caitlin, for giving us as much of your time. We really appreciate you and the work that you do in the space. You are tremendous at what you do. And if you aren't following Caitlin by now, I don't know what you're doing. Just please take care of that, handle that, become a smarter basketball fan. Anyway, thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We're having fun discussions in there. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. If you have a League Pass subscription, you want to watch hoops with us. We have a ton of fun real-time analysis. We're breaking down plays during timeouts and commercial breaks. It's also just a wholesome and inclusive community. So if you want to let your hair down, joke around with us, you can also do that. Just come have some fun with us. The link to the room is in your podcast description. It should be hyperlinked. If so, click that link into your information. It is free, no shenanigans. And if it isn't hyperlinked, just copy and paste the link into your browser. Once again, it is free, no shenanigans. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Bye.